KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
In Seattle.
Welcome to a Tuesday edition of Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. We'll be out in the garden with you later 2 hours. We will be talking with our gardening crew. We're also going to talk about what it's like to live and work in a traditional Japanese farm. We're going to get an update on what happened in Columbia City when Bellevue's SWAT team was engaged in that neighborhood. Find out about living with bipolar disorder and a critique of President Obama's foreign policy from a former Obama staffer, Vali Nasser. But we're going to start with the Teacher of the Year. I'm Steve Scheer, by the way. Jeff Charbonneau has been named the 2013 National Teacher of the Year. He's already Washington's State Teacher of the Year. He was chosen as the national teacher from among all the other great teachers across the country. He's a science teacher, teaching 9th through 12th grade chemistry, physics, and engineering at Zilla High School in Zilla, Washington. He's also the regional STEM innovator, science, technology, engineering, and math. He graduated from Zilla High School in 1996, and he receives his award from President Obama at the White House later this morning. He sees his job as teacher and coach.
And I say coach because we think of coaches a little bit differently than we think of teachers. Coaches are there to inspire, they're there to encourage and really see the best in their players and then work on developing their skills and their talents from there. But in reality, I think that's what teachers do too. You know, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of my job is that I'm there to build positive relationships with students. You know, the content is secondary. If I can make those positive relationships first, I can see where the student is coming from, understand their backgrounds, and appreciate them for their differences and similarities in my classroom. Then I can build an appropriate education for them. And once you do that, boy, you get the students on your side, and you can take them to a place educationally that you might not have gotten to before. You can have that high content and high rigor.
But you only have those students for a limited amount of time. How can you build those sorts of long-lasting relationships?
Well, you know, I think it can still be done. You know, even though it's a limited amount of time, you know, you're still going to be with them for, you know, 180 days over the course of a year, you know, maybe for an hour or so per day, depending on your schedule. And so that is a significant amount of time. But on top of that, most teachers are also involved in some sort of extracurricular activity. Myself, I'm an assistant drama director, yearbook advisor, science club advisor, and more. And so I'm able to see these students in lots of different ways.
When do you find time to teach them the core STEM programs?
Absolutely. You know, but we're doing that all the time. You know, even as you're building those relationships, you're still teaching content. I think one of the best things about teaching is that it's something that never stops. You know, you're not only teaching the lesson that you have planned within the classroom, but when you see a student on the street or at the grocery store, you're still teaching and you're still talking about things that are relevant to science. You know, so often we think of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics as simply being robotics. You know, now I'm a robotics advisor. I started my own robotics club, so definitely I'm a big fan of robotics. But there's a softer side of STEM as well. It's going to Woodland Park Zoo. It's going to the aquarium. It's going up to Mount Rainier. It's going to these places where you can see the softer side of science. And you can see, you know, biology and diversity and whatnot. So STEM is all around us. There's definitely time to teach it as well.
Jeff Charbonneau has been named the 2013 National Teacher of the Year. He's a science teacher, teaching 9th through 12th grade chemistry, physics, engineering at Zilla High School in Zilla, Washington. He's also the regional STEM innovator, science, technology, engineering, math. Graduated from Zilla High School in 1996. What's different about the experience you had in 1996 and the experience your students have today?
You know, we can certainly look at the technology differences. You know, when I was in school, very few computers were around. In my engineering classrooms today, we're using CAD or computer-aided design to do engineering. We have a 3D printer in the classroom, so students are able to create something on a computer and then literally hold it in their hands moments later. You know, so there's that aspect of it, but I'll tell you what's the same. And the same is the quality of teachers that are in Zilla, the quality of teachers that we have in Washington State. They're caring, they're compassionate, you know, and they're really focused on a very nuanced education, one that takes into consideration the individual needs of each student. So if we can continue to do that, if we can continue to look at our students as individuals and adapt and evolve our instruction based off of them, And then at the same time, incorporate the new technologies and the new things that have come about, you know, not only within computer science, but within aviation and physics and the rest, then I think we're doing our job pretty well.
What's your average class size?
You know, it ranges somewhere between about 18 and 24 students, somewhere in there. You know, you would think that teaching the physics and the chemistry and the engineering classes, I'd have smaller classes, but that's actually not the case. My physics classes typically are full every year, and we have a lot of students that are very eager to be challenged. You know, one of the best things that you can do in education is continually raise the bar and raise that level of rigor. You know, I've talked a lot about that focus on individual students first, but once you can do that, that rigor can go much higher. Every single course that I teach is actually counts for college credit, either through Yakima Valley Community College, Central Washington University, or Eastern Washington University. So the rigor in the course content is definitely there, and that's really one of the best things about teaching.
Are you self-selecting and getting the best students?
Or
are the students, self-selecting, I should say, and coming to you because you're the best teacher?
You know, I don't know that I'm the best teacher. You know, the best teacher is the one that matches up with the student's personality. You know, so I've got a teacher right next door that's absolutely phenomenal. He connects with students in a different way than I do, and he's really, really good at what he does. But as far as selecting students, I've got 9th through 12th grade students. I've got students who are, you know, enrolled in special education courses but are also taking engineering for college credit. You know, so I've got all ranges and all abilities. And I see all ranges and all abilities as opportunities for them to succeed. Sometimes a student will come to me with a traditionally poor math background in their academic history. But then they see engineering in a new light, and they see a different relevance for the mathematics. And suddenly math makes sense to them. You know, so it's not about selecting individual students based off of prior academic history or anything like that. It's about selecting students who are willing to challenge themselves and willing to apply themselves in the classroom.
Jeff Charbonneau has been named the 2013 National Teacher of the Year. He teaches chemistry, physics, engineering at Zilla High School. You know, I hear in your voice a calling, if I may interpret
sure.
for a moment. And is what you do replicable? Can other teachers learn from you?
Absolutely, just as I have learned from other teachers. It's something that can be replicated. It is something that can be taught because I've seen it in so many places. I've seen it in Zilla High School. I've seen it at Toppenish. I've seen it in Yakima. I've seen it in the Seattle schools. There's great teachers out there.
Well, what's keeping it from being replicated? I mean, why do we still see test scores or even graduation rates that don't seem to be rising?
Well, you know, there's a couple of different things that you got to keep in mind with something like test scores. Test scores are a part of the equation. You know, I equate it to my classroom. If in my classroom the only thing that I did grade-wise was give a final at the very end, and I based the entire grade for my students on the final exam, I'd have an awful lot of parents pretty upset with me for inappropriate grading practices. And I think that sometimes when we look only at test scores, we're doing the same type of thing. We're putting so much weight on one part of it. Now, do I give a final? Yes. Are statewide tests as a final, are those appropriate? Absolutely. I think that it's important for us to do testing, and it's important for us to look at those scores. But I think it's also important for us to look at the whole student and the rest of the equation in education.
What about graduation rates?
You know, graduation rates are rising. We have one of the highest graduation rates nationwide than we've had since the early 1970s. And yet we're also teaching a whole different student. You know, students are different today than they were 20, 30, and 40 years ago. And so we are improving. Now, I totally admit we have an awful long way to go. We're trying some new strategies. We're trying to implement some new ideas to improve graduation rates and also to close the achievement gap. We've got an awful lot of work to do. And I you know, I don't have all the solutions, but I hope that together with the other educators in our nation, we can figure it out.
Do you have a particular model you base your teaching on?
You know, the model that I use is I have a very cliche statement that I start my classroom every day. I say, welcome back to another day in paradise. And that's my model. The model is be positive about what's happening right in your life. Be aware of the things that maybe aren't going as well and do something to change it. You know, we do live in a paradise in the United States of America. If you think and look around you for just a few minutes, you have access to the Internet so easily in our state. You have access to such amazing resources. There's an awful lot to be very positive about. So So let's be positive about those things first, have a nice outlook on life, and then start focusing on those areas we can improve. Leopard Pathfinders is an extension of my high school science club. It's a outdoor backpacking and hiking program where we take students up into the Cascade Mountain Range, up on White Pass and Chinook Pass. We do some fish planting for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, where we take and backpack fish into some of the high alpine lakes and plant them. We've also gone to Yellowstone National Park and the Beartooth Mountains of Montana. And the whole goal of the program is to expose students to that softer side of STEM, that other part of science that we don't normally think about when we think about STEM education. It's the idea of getting students to be aware of their environment and aware of the resources that are out there for us.
You know, you graduated from Zilla High School. You went to Central Washington. You got a master's at Central Washington. Now you're a National Board Certified Teacher. When you have students getting ready to graduate and you look at them and they say, oh, I should be going to the UW or I should be going to an Ivy League school, which costs more and is harder to get into, what do you tell them?
I tell them to make sure and pick a university that matches their personality. You know, the University of Washington is a fantastic school. I've had students that have gone there. I have a student just a few years ago is now down at Stanford. You know, so we've had students that are going to those prestigious universities, as well as students going to Yakima Valley Community College, which I think is just as appropriate for some of them. So match the college or the university or the trade school, you know, that fits your personality. I think we put sometimes a little bit too much focus just on college, and then never limit yourself. Always push yourself to continue to improve.
You're very positive. I do wonder, is there anything in the teaching profession?
Sure.
Rules from principals, rules from the Department of Education, rules from your union, rules from fellow teachers. Is there anything that is keeping you from achieving what you want to achieve as a teacher?
You know, I think that there's always going to be barriers for folks to figure out how to navigate. You know, as I've worked through my teaching career, there's been a lot of opportunities for other people to tell me no to a different program or thing that I wanted to implement. And my role as a teacher and my role as a teacher leader is to figure out the ways that we can make those things still happen. You know, and through the three different colleges and universities I've worked with, YBC, Central, and Eastern, that now count my classes for college credit, each one of those was a little bit challenging to make those agreements. You know, I do not have a PhD in any of those subject areas, and traditionally a university professor would. You know, so you've got to figure out how to navigate those barriers. You know, does that drive me nuts from time to time? Certainly. I think red tape is there to drive people nuts to a certain extent. But there's ways around it, and there's ways you can navigate it, and there's always opportunity there.
What's next for you in your professional career?
You know, that's a great question. As National Teacher of the Year, starting in June, I will have the opportunity to change my classroom. I'll be leaving the classroom in Zilla High School to instead go and basically tour the United States as a spokesperson for education. Also tour a few countries of the world where I'll do somewhere around 140 to 150 speeches over the course of a year. And also be there to learn from other teachers and to see their classrooms and to interact with them and hopefully bring some of those practices back. After that year, I'll then return to Zilla High School, hopefully to exactly the same classroom and continue teaching those same courses, but hopefully more informed. You know, I'm not done learning as an educator, and I really look forward to learning more and how I can continue to be a voice for education in our state and also for our country.
Well, Jeff Charbonneau, I thank you very much for your work. I know you're heading over to receive the award from the president, right?
That is correct. At approximately 2:15 Eastern time, about 11:15 a.m. Pacific time, I'll be at the White House. We'll do a ceremony in the Rose Garden with all of the state teachers of the year, where President Obama will present me with the National Teacher of the Year Award. And then I get exactly 2 minutes to give a little speech there in the White House grounds. So it's going to be an absolutely amazing opportunity. It's going to be streamed live on the White House's website, so you can tune into that.
Your students going to be watching?
Hey, absolutely, absolutely.
Jeff Charbonneau of Zilla, Washington, is the 2013 National Teacher of the Year. This is Weekday.
Minutes past 9 o'clock. President Obama's foreign policy, is it too cautious and a danger to the future peace and security of the planet? Our next guest says yes. We'll find out why in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting La Voix Humaine with Swore Angelica. Poulenc and Puccini present two stories of women on the verge in this new-to-Seattle double bill. May 4th through 18th at McCaw Hall. Details at seattleopera.org.
49 degrees in Seattle under a mostly clear sky, expecting lots of sun today and a high of 65.
Support for KUOW comes from Hammer and Hand, dedicated to stewardship of the built environment through craft and science, collaborating with clients and architects on high-performance buildings and remodels throughout Seattle. From classic renovations to modernist passive house buildings, hammerandhand.com.
What does it feel like to be bipolar, and how does that mental illness affect family relationships? We'll find out in 20 minutes.
President Obama's foreign policy emphasizes China and Asia these days instead of the Middle East and Europe. The administration says it's shifting military resources and diplomatic energy as China expands its global footprint. Vali Nasser is author of The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. He's a former State Department advisor under Richard Holbrooke. He is currently the dean of the Johns Hopkins University Paul H. Nitze School of Advanced and International Studies. He joins us from that part of the world. Vali Nasser, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
It's good to be with you. Your city's a little calmer these days, right?
Indeed, indeed.
You know, you wrote towards the end of the book, our aim, you're talking about the United States, our aim for the past 4 years has been to engage less, do less, and have a smaller footprint. Give me some examples of what you mean by that.
Well, we have gone from being the forefront of global leadership in convening powers and allies around the world to address global issues to, by and large, adopting a wait-and-see approach for events and trends to unfold and then selectively engage when there is a crisis is imminent. This was evident in our approach to the Arab Spring, which is the most important historical transformation in a very critical area of the world where we have, by and large, not taken a frontal role in trying to decide the outcome or shape the events on the ground. It applies to developments in Europe, where by and large we have been sitting on the sideline. And I think even it applies to issues in Asia, where the conflict between Japan and North Korea or Japan and China over the disputed islands, that by and large we have stood back and allowed events to take their direction. And generally, we have done this under the guise that we need to be focused at home and that American leadership is not as important and as decisive as we used to think. And we should not take a leading role in deciding the direction of global politics.
Now, of course, that's not the stated goal of the Obama administration. They would never say American leadership is not as important. Or do you think they have stated that?
I think at times they have. Virtually every high-level senior official who's gone to the Middle East has made it very clear that we wish to do less and shrink our footprint there. But I think more importantly, around the world, people don't look at what we say. They look at what we do. In Asia, in North Korea would look at the way we approach Syria or the way we approach Egypt or the way we're handling Iran and then make decision as to how much room they have in order to push. Our allies in Asia look at the manner in which we are trying to reduce our footprint in the Middle East and then make calculations about the degree to which they can depend on the United States in making their own policies. So, you know, there is a general sense that the United States is not only internally focused, but also really doesn't think that its global leadership either matters to itself or matters to the world, or that it's really the duty and mandate of the United States to be the global leader. And this is the larger message that people are getting. Nobody comes out and openly puts down in paper in black and white that we don't want to lead. But our actions and our reactions very clearly say that we really don't want to lead in the manner that we did in the past.
Of course, the manner that we did in the past, the recent past, how do you interpret the recent past being starting in 2000 and 2001, perhaps? How do you interpret that style of leadership?
Well, there is definitely the overhang of Iraq on everything we do, in our public discussions, in the media, in our government circles. But it is a mistake to shape our future foreign policy based on a comparison with the Bush administration. There were catastrophic mistakes that happened there that drained our resources, that tarnished our global image. But the world is no longer facing Iraq 2003. The world is facing other crises. For people in the Middle East, the issue is Syria, not Iraq. The issue in the Middle East is Egypt, not Iraq. The issue in Asia is North Korea, not Iraq. They want to see where are we going to be going from here on and whether we are going to lead and lead better. Whereas we internally are constantly doing this comparison between whether the Obama administration is a better alternative to the Bush administration. I'm willing to concede that right now, that it is a far better approach to foreign policy than the Bush administration was. But the reality is that it is not what we ought, it is not where we ought to be, and that adopting a small footprint is also damaging in very different ways. And I also would say that this is not about either we invade countries and completely dominate them and set out to change their character and build democracies out of nothing. And then we say, well, the antidote to that is to do nothing. And when the Middle East is actually turning towards democracy, we're not really there to help economically, diplomatically, politically, and we let things just drift in whatever direction they want.
You know, this book has been called a gloves-off assessment of the Obama administration, mm-hmm. Vali Nasr, the dispensable nation, American foreign policy in retreat. And I guess your gloves are off right in the first page. A White House that had jealously guarded all foreign policy making and then relied heavily on the military and intelligence agencies to guide its decisions. And then, when things seemed to be falling apart, the administration finally turned to Hillary because they knew she was the only person who could save the situation. Give me some example.
Well, one examples of that in Afghanistan, Pakistan, in the Middle East are fairly abundant. On the case of Pakistan, the situation between our two countries got very dense when there was a border clash between U.S. forces and Pakistani forces, and 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed. There was recriminations on both sides, and then the Pakistanis demanded that they wanted an apology. And the United States decided that it would actually raise the pressure on them. The policy was largely favored by the U.S. military and the CIA to put a lot of pressure on the Pakistanis so they would back down. The Pakistanis instead closed the road that supplies our troops in Afghanistan, and it's the main conduit in and out of Afghanistan for the U.S. military. Pressure didn't work for a whole year almost, and ultimately the president deputed the Secretary of State Clinton to negotiate with the Pakistanis a face-saving situation which would allow us to have access to that road again, that for the Pakistanis to at least get a modicum of U.S. Acknowledgement of what had happened on the border, and that restored the situation. You look at the Arab world, Clinton was generally the person who on the forefront often was a very tough voice, but was very assertive with American leadership, but was also the one that guided U.S. policy, but ended up on a deadline. In Libya, it was she who argued that the United States could not let the Europeans essentially to run this war on its own. It will fail. It will not be good for U.S. leadership in the region. And the United States could not be seen to be sitting on the sidelines when Muammar Gaddafi was going to butcher his own people. So she's the one who pushed the administration to get engaged on Libya and support the opposition to get rid of Gaddafi.
You know, just because you brought it up, what happened in Benghazi from your assessment? Why were those diplomats in a situation where they could be killed?
Well, I wasn't in the government then, so my views are not based on firsthand information about that. I think that after Gaddafi left, the security situation in Libya as a whole began to collapse. We also, as well as the Europeans, were not very engaged with helping shore up state institutions very quickly. We sort of thought that the mission in Libya ended the minute Gaddafi left. We didn't realize that the real big job would start afterwards, and that that provided ample room for Al-Qaeda, extremist forces, brigands, all of them to organize. And ultimately, American consulate and embassies became target for this. Their response to having adequate security on the ground lagged largely because I think our vision in Washington was one that this country was on track to democracy. Gaddafi had gone away. And therefore, we didn't think of this as a worsening security scenario. And generally, I think it was symptomatic of the fact that our eyes were not on the Middle East. I mean, I think this is a larger problem and that, than just saying that somebody did not sign requests for additional security forces to be sent to Benghazi to protect the embassy. I think that's a very narrow view of what went wrong. What went wrong largely was that at the minute Gaddafi left, the U.S. government basically washed its hands of Libya and started looking somewhere else, and Libya was left to fend for itself.
Well, let me take you back to your main contention then. The as you start the book, you're saying the Obama administration is and President Obama is letting foreign policy be run by people who have domestic political concerns at the forefront. Why would the president be so, seems naive, to do that?
Well, I think generally speaking, this administration is not concerned with foreign policy to the extent that it should be, that its main focus is on its domestic agenda, which some may argue is the way things ought to be. But there are important foreign policy issues out there that do impinge on U.S. interest in important ways. But I think it's a symptom of the fact that the president does not take foreign policy seriously. He's not a foreign policy president. That foreign policy decisions from very early on were taken in light of how they would play out in the domestic political scene. People who ran America's foreign policy, his closest advisors, the ones who collated information, helped him make decisions, were people who came from the campaign, whose eyes were on the re-election of 2012, and who viewed how we handle Afghanistan, how we handle the Middle East, largely in light of what impact it would have on the domestic political scene and how it might be interpreted in the news cycle domestically. I think, the president is a very intelligent man, but by and large, I think his presidency is defined by minimizing our foreign policy exposure and not taking risks on the foreign policy arena. And therefore, management of foreign policy fell by and large into a mold of being subservient to what were generally domestic political concerns for his team.
Sarah Chase, a colleague of yours during your time working with Richard Holbrooke, writes in Foreign Policy, the title of it, which is, What You Got Wrong, What Valley Nasser Got Wrong. She says, Nasser's contention that the Afghanistan mission suffered perhaps fatally from a lack of input by diplomatic leaders. But the real question is, input to what end? What was and what should have been the content of that input? And she goes on to say the problem was that the input was also arcane, hard to interpret, that the diplomats just weren't giving the military leaders or the political leaders what they needed to understand what was happening in Afghanistan. What do you say to that?
Well, I think she misses the point entirely. First of all, I don't think the State Department should have been dealing with those issues like agriculture, growing pomegranates in Afghanistan at all. The reason the State Department was dealing with those issues is because the State Department was not being allowed to do what the State Department should do, which is diplomacy, arriving at a peace process, negotiations, facilitating relations between regional countries, bringing them to a consensus to an end on Afghanistan. The military wanted the State Department not to do those things. They didn't want to see a peace process. They wanted the State Department to be managing aid. Secondly, the point Chase misses is not what low-level State Department interactions with military commanders meant or whether they're relevant. The question is whether the president or the White House was listening to the Secretary of State and his own special envoy at the highest level about what should be the roadmap for an end to the war in Afghanistan. And he wasn't. So that message was not arcane. The message of Richard Holbrooke was very clear. Don't surge. Don't put 130,000 troops on the ground, because the more you put in on the ground, the sooner you will withdraw. Put less number of troops, keep them longer, have a credible position on the ground, and push for a regionally supported political settlement for Afghanistan. That's not an arcane message. And that's not a message you give to a low-level commander on the ground. That's a message that happens in the Situation Room at the White House. And that's what my book is about. I'm not writing about what a consular-level officer may have told a sergeant or a brigadier in Kandahar. I think, by and large, I would say, interpreting that way is a deliberate attempt to obfuscate the message of the book.
You know, you're right. We have not won this war, Afghanistan, on the battlefield, nor have we ended it at the negotiating table. We're just washing our hands of it, hoping there will be a decent interval of calm, a reasonable distance between us and the catastrophe that's going to follow. What is going to happen in Afghanistan?
Well, the Taliban will have all of their force intact. They have their refuge. They are perfectly capable of projecting power in southern Afghanistan. And those forces in Afghanistan that fear a Taliban onslaught northwards are currently arming. You have a very weak political center in Afghanistan led by a mercurial leader, Karzai, whose political basis in Afghanistan is quite fragile. Afghanistan more than likely would end up in a conflict between its Tajik and Hazara and Uzbek minorities and its Pashtun population to the south, between the Taliban and what used to be the Northern Alliance. The regional actors around Afghanistan, with none of whom we have an agreement about the future of Afghanistan, each has their own dog in the fight and are going to pursue their individual interests. Russia, Uzbekistan, Iran, Pakistan, India, and China are all going to get into this act. So, by and large, Afghanistan is going to go back to where it was before 2001, and it's going to go back to an internal conflict, to a mess socially, economically, will become a security concern for us. And there, all of the issues that we thought were important, the rights of women, education, stability for the region, all of those issues will be at jeopardy once more.
Well, you write that as the United States says it's pivoting to confront China in China's backyard, China is pivoting to the rest of the world, and that the Chinese vision may be a more self-interested, a mercantilist vision of the future global order. But what would China's interest be in allowing that sort of chaos to take place? Don't they have an interest in trying to tamp down the violence that could erupt?
They do, but how they do it, to what cost, and empowering whom is of great concern to us. So would, for instance, in a Persian Gulf, without the United States, China look to Pakistan and Iran to establish hegemony in that region? Would that be all right with us? Or if the Chinese support illiberal regimes, authoritarian regimes, regimes that abuse their human rights, would that be all right with us? If the Chinese support a much more strident Arab case against Israel in the Middle East, would that be all right with us? If the Chinese establish sufficient hegemony to dictate a price of oil and gas for our allies in Asia, in India, in Europe, would that be all right with us? It is not that the Chinese favor chaos. They don't. But that the Chinese may influence Middle East politics in ways that we might be uncomfortable with it. We're already seeing a shade of this happening in South China Sea with Southeast Asia and with Japan, where once China begins to spread its wings, it has a different style and a different way of asserting control and establishing its power that we clearly are not comfortable with.
Well, you see an America in retreat, but you also just laid out concerns that could have easily been ascribed in your book to how we've approached some of the nations of the world in terms of allowing autocrats to rule because of our own interests. Take a step back for me and tell me what you see. If this is the America you see, what do you see in 5 years in America and its relation to the world?
Well, I think, you know, generally the world complains a lot about America, and we have done many, committed many mistakes in our management of global affairs. But by and large, I think we have been a force for good because we have brought a certain stability and predictability to the world order. And the world is not ready for the United States disappearing immediately and quickly. It is not equipped to deal all of a sudden on its own. And a sudden departure of the United States is sudden taking your hands off of a management where you were there before is quite disruptive. And I don't think we should look at it and say, well, because we made mistakes, the antidote to having made mistakes or the response to having made mistakes is just to disappear and just not be there. That is equally damaging. The United States made grave mistakes in the Middle East, particularly in the form of the Iraq War. But right now, the United States not being engaged in the most important historical transformation in that region is also quite damaging. Take the case of Egypt, the most important Arab country. It's going democratic. It is in turbulence. Its economy is a sham. And there is no degree of international support, which usually is led by the United States, to help Egypt through this phase. Compare Egypt with Poland, with Argentina, with Russia, with countries in Southeast Asia. When those countries went democratic, see how much American engagement, economic in particular, financial and political and diplomatic, existed in the first 2-3 years of democratization in those countries, and how much exists today. The president went to Myanmar for a 6-hour visit to reward the generals in that country for allowing elections. He hasn't been to a single country in the Middle East that went through the Arab Spring. And just as the Middle East was reeling from our overreach under the Bush administration because of its doing too much, being too ambitious and too militaristic, it is also in some ways suffering because of our complete disengagement in Syria and Egypt. And I don't think one excuses the other. We have to have a sensible foreign policy that protects our interests and is good for the world. And I don't think that's where we are. And I think the hope in the region, in the world, for President Obama would not be that when he came in, he would be the sort of the anti-Bush, the exact opposite, but that he would really construct a forward-leaning, appropriate American leadership for the world. There is a tremendous amount of thirst for good American leadership in the world. And that came out of disappointment with President Bush's presidency. And I underline the fact there is desire for good American leadership. There is no desire for no American leadership.
Vali Nasser, he's author of The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. Thank you for talking to us, sir.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday.
We'll get some insight into what it's like to live with bipolar disorder in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from ACT Theater, presenting Assisted Living, a band of senior misfits rediscovers purpose and dignity in the face of a system stacked against them in this comedy that dares to confront the issue of aging in America. Now through May 12th. Tickets at acttheater.org.
51 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Expecting sun all day with an afternoon high of 65 and more sun tomorrow.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth between ages 13 and 21 to participate in a study of a smartphone app in a self-directed weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
It's 9:44. Terrorism-related arrests in Spain in the news at 10.
What's it like to feel bipolar? This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. Katie Sewell spoke with Janine Crowley-Haynes to find out. She's author of My Kind of Crazy, Living in a Bipolar World, a memoir she wrote about being bipolar.
Yeah, and last week we heard Janine describe how she was diagnosed. Last week we heard Janine describe how she was diagnosed and treated for bipolar and how that affected her relationship with her husband and her son. Today, in part two, she'll tell us what treatments you should be seeking out if you feel like you might be bipolar. I asked her how it actually feels to be bipolar.
I would say I was very ashamed, embarrassed. When I was first diagnosed, I really didn't want too many people to know. I felt that stigma. I didn't want people to really attach that word to who I was. It was sort of like a character flaw that I thought. And as time went on, it went on for like 10 years where people, neighbors knew I was in the hospital again, and friends had to know because it was happening every year I was out of commission for 5 weeks and even longer once I came home from the hospital. So I had a lot of learning to do, owning up to my illness and just admitting that this is something I need to take control of. I cannot let it control me anymore. And that was pretty much like a breakthrough for me. Realizing that, oh, I can manage this. It's an illness, or I don't even like calling it an illness. It's a disorder in my brain, a chemical imbalance. I can manage this by doing certain things, coping techniques, preemptive strike is being proactive, being honest, knowing when you feel like you're. And if anybody out there who's bipolar, they know when they're cycling, and you really have to get in touch with that part of you, because it's very easy to say, oh no, I'll let it go. I'll let it go a little while because the mania feels so good. And then crash.
What do you make of the fear that some people exhibit towards people with mental illness, or discomfort, or just not knowing how to interact mm-hmm. with people with mental illness?
A lot, people react differently. In the beginning, there are some people who are very afraid of it. And I understand that because they don't know about it. And then once they find out that I'm bipolar, some people will say to me, oh, my mother was bipolar, or, a sister has issues, always did. And then they start to open up and talk about somebody in their family or a friend. And it's 1 in 4. In a given year, 1 in 4 people suffer from a mental illness, maybe not as severe as I get them, but you look around and there's something that somebody is either dealing with, whether it's depression or anxiety. Even grief can bring on a severe depression.
Where do you think the fear comes from, though?
Well, the stigma, of being in the loony bin and hiding the uncle in the attic. No one spoke about people in their families who had issues. They were put away, and then they went away sometimes too, and institutionalized and committed for the duration of their life. And it's sad because not only does it happen today, but I find that even in well-educated, affluent communities, it's a hush-hush topic. No one wants to speak of it because of reputations, because of professions. And I understand that, because if you're a doctor, let's say, and you suffer from bipolar disorder, does a patient really want to know that? Or if you're a teacher with young children, they're a police officer. I understand that there should be a privacy Not everybody could be out of the crazy closet like I am. I just happened to be fortunate enough to talk about it in a book and try and help people, even if they don't want to be public about their illness, that they should get help. They should seek out a really good doctor, psychiatrist with psychopharmacology in their background. That's really important for a chemical imbalance. DBSA is, I don't know if you have them out here.
DBSA?
Yeah, it's Depression Bipolar Support Alliance. And it's sort of like a 12-step program. It's like group therapy. People meet in churches, basements of churches and synagogues. And I've spoken for them. I've come to group meetings and shared the book and my message, story.
Mm-hmm. You touched briefly in the book about the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And how being bipolar makes you view them differently.
Yes. Well, I could be one of them. I grew up in New York and working in the city. I'd pass, this is before I even was ever had a diagnosis, and I'd ride the subway and there was a man, you know, with tinfoil antennas, you know, oops, playing his saxophone, telling us that he comes from another planet and he's here to soothe us with his music. And then I'd walk by a homeless woman with a sign, you know, we'll work for food. And never thought twice about the person screaming on the corner at no one. Just, you know, they were scary. And but the difference between them and me is that I have health insurance. And health insurance, honestly, is not enough. I think they only give you like 2 weeks, 2 weeks of hospitalization. And mental illness takes a good 2 months, sometimes even 3 months to recover fully. Not saying that you have to be in the hospital that long, but outpatient programs should be covered. You know, it's just, it's sad because I can see the difference between being well and having to manage bipolar disorder because of health insurance, because of family support, and the people who are homeless on the streets that don't get that help. And a lot of them refuse to take medication, too. It's about educating.
What do you think society or me as an individual's responsibility to those people are?
I do believe that we do have a responsibility to try and help them, and the programs should be offered. And it's sad to see, because I know that most of them could be helped if they got the right care.
I'm speaking with Janine Crowley-Haynes. She's the author of My Kind of Crazy, Living in a Bipolar World. Part of your disorder that you write about in the book is hallucinations, seeing things that aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe three different characters that are in your brain that come out from time to time. And I was hoping you would explain who they are and maybe what they represent to you.
I'm so glad you're asking this, because a lot of people never ask me about The Quiet Room, and I love that chapter. And part of it is interesting because I was in solitary confinement, which was called The Quiet Room. And I landed in there after a very angry group therapy session where I was shouting at a patient. And I landed in the quiet room to calm down. And so they came in and they gave me some nice anti-anxiety medication, which strung me out a little bit and started to, you know, see things. And I have been visited before by them in dreams or waking up. And so I called it a tea party, and I brought out the fine china that was inherited, which, like, my mental illness has been inherited. I have mental illness on both sides of my family. And so the tea set represents what the fine china that I've inherited. And my place settings were a young teenage type boy who is very quiet and tall with very, you know, just comfortable clothes but wrinkled, and just he would just look at me, like in my dreams too, when I was sleeping, he'd come and visit me and just stand over me and look at me, and I always felt a sense of peace and with his presence. And then the other lady was scary. I would wake up sometimes and open my eyes, and she'd be this close to me, with bulging eyes and growling at me, and I would wake up from my sleep screaming. And I decided one night after many visits that I was going to growl at her back when she came. And sure enough, I did, and like the image melted and disappeared. So in the quiet room, they showed up to the tea party, the two of them, and also another fetus that kept asking me, what's my name? What's my name? And I would say, I don't know. I don't know what your name is. And he was insistent to remind me that his name was Daniel and that I shouldn't forget it. But each time that happens, I always forget his name.
What do you make of these three characters?
Well, my son has a philosophy. He asked me, do you think that the teenage boy was me? He said, do you think that's me in the future? And I was like, that's an interesting observation, maybe. You know, I did feel a peace with him and a presence. We can go into whether or not psychosis is, you know, there are people, even biblical references of people having visions, and they claim to be from God. My visions landed me in a psych ward. I remember trying to convince people that I was Jesus Christ in female form when I was in the psych ward, trying to convince other patients. And believing it, too.
Are the hallucinations fun at all?
Some are. Some are. But some are scary, too. And sometimes not just hallucinations, but the tactile psychosis of feeling things on you. Not a good feeling.
Does that make you wary of what is true and what is fake?
Yes.
On a daily basis?
Yes. At times I need confirmation. I need to say, is that really there? We had a snake in our basement once, and we had come in from the garage into the basement. And it was at the time my son was small, so he had all those rubber-like insects and snakes and all those types of toys. So as a mom, you pick things up as you go along. And so Stephen and Larry went up the stairs, and I bent down to pick up the rubber snake, and the head stood up and looked at me. And I wasn't sure whether or not it was real or my hallucinations. And I had to call my husband down to say, is this looking at me? Sure enough, it was.
It's a good thing you asked instead of just grabbing onto it, I suppose.
Exactly.
So maybe just to end, you thank your father in the credits, and you also talk a bit about your mother. What role have your parents played as far as you learning how to deal with this disorder?
Everything. My mother is just the wisest person I've ever encountered. And I'm not just saying that because she's my mom, but she was wise beyond her years. And after my mom and dad split up when we were young, I was about 11, she took on the role of both mother and father, and just, you know, bra-burning 1970s free single divorcee woman who had three girls to raise, and very strong and very just loving and always giving us that positive reinforcement that we're worthy. Just a lot of love and a lot of humor. And that's how my mother coped, and that's where I learned my sense of humor as well. My father, I loved him dearly. You know, he was a fun dad when we were really young and affectionate, but he was an alcoholic. A happy drunk, though, so he was a lot of fun to be with. Like, our days out were the bar for Shirley Temple's when we should have been at the park, like my mother asked him to take us. But looking back, he was bipolar. He had cycles, and he does what a lot of people do, self-medicate with alcohol. He was never diagnosed and suffered most of his life.
Janine Crowley-Haynes is the author of My Kind of Crazy, Living in a Bipolar World. Thanks for making the journey in.
Oh, thanks, Katie. This is great.
If you missed the first part of our interview with Janine Crowley-Haynes, where she describes her bipolar disorder and how it affected her family, find it at our website, kuow.org. And we're going to bring you that hike to match the week's weather in about half an hour. Stay with us. You're listening to Weekday on 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
It's a minute before 10 o'clock. A controversial police shooting last month in Columbia City. What happened and how are residents responding? Folks there met with officials last night, but people went away unsatisfied. KUOW's Patricia Murphy tells us more just a couple minutes from now. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Kirkland Choral Society, presenting Songs of America with the rich heritage of American music, with songs such as O Shenandoah, Buffalo Gals, and more. Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Bastyr University Chapel. Tickets at KirklandChoralSociety.org or Brown Paper Tickets.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.